He kept us out of war. That was the campaign slogan for Woodrow Wilson in 1916. But within about 5 months of that election, the United States was very much in the war that would become known as World War I. What prompted that? Was it the sinking of the Lusitania? Was it something called the Zimmerman Telegram? Was it something else or some combination of things? We're going to look at the entry of the United States into World War I in the spring of 1917. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is John Hall. He's a professor of history, also a member of the Wisconsin World War I Centennial Commission. And welcome back to University of the Air.
Thanks, Norman. Happy to be here.
Well, before we get into the United States entering the war, which is actually pretty late in the course of this whole conflict in Europe, let's revisit, perhaps, the causes that set this thing off in the first place in 1914.
Well, this is the most famous case, I think, that people are familiar with, of entangling alliances, sort of compelling nations into war, not necessarily in accordance with their best interests. Historians have sort of disputed over the years who really deserves the blame. In the immediate aftermath of the war in 1918, of course, everybody knew exactly where to put the blame.
On the loser, of course.
Yes. And in the post-1920 era, historians generally went along with that interpretation, that Germany and Austro-Hungary were the principal aggressors in this war. And that consensus lasted for quite a while, and there were some challenges later to it. Most recently, there's a sort of neo-revisionist challenge that has gained some currency with a well-known book called Sleepwalkers, which suggests that it was the Entente powers that sleepwalked into a catastrophe in Europe, and that Germany and Austro-Hungary were in fact behaving rationally given their security situation and so forth. I think it's maybe safe to say, however, the consensus view remains that in these two key Central Powers allies of Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you've got a tale of two great powers heading in opposite directions, that the Austro-Hungarian Empire is rotting within. It is no longer the great and mighty polity that it had once been, and in a sort of fragile condition, it can brook no insults, no indignities to its greatness. And hence, following the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, Austro-Hungary has to respond very, very stridently and indeed unreasonably against Serbia. On the other hand, its closest ally, Germany, is a power on the rise. It's a relatively new power, still centered in Berlin, a Prussian-centered, fairly recently unified German state, which has pretty grand ambitions. And so those that would defend Germany's role here sees the strategic reality that Germany is closely allied with Austro-Hungary, which has suffered the sort of insult that it cannot brook. When Russia responds as the historic defender of Slavic peoples, vowing to come to Serbia's defense, Germany realizes it's caught between a rock and a hard place because for the past nearly 20 years, I think it is, Russia had been allied with France. And that puts Germany, although an industrially powerful and fairly populous nation at the center of Europe, it's a nation that finds itself literally surrounded by enemies with limited access to the sea. And these are the entangling alliances that compel the Germans to take the initiative. They see the war is coming, anticipate inevitably the war is going to involve France as well. And all of their planning that they're very professional and within a narrowly military sense, a competent German general staff had assumed that because France is the greater threat, the more exigent threat, and particularly after the way that the Russians had fared in the Russo-Japanese War earlier in the century.
They lost
in a very embarrassing fashion. They thought Russia would have a very hard time mobilizing, and so using sound military principles, we'll strike our enemy's enemy first, that being France, try to win the war against France in rapid fashion and then turn around and redirect our forces to the Eastern Front to deal with Russia, which was supposed to be lumbering and bumbling. and indeed, there's probably a hope within Germany they'll never actually have to pivot to face Russia because some were probably hoping that the mere act of mobilizing the Russian nation for war would cause a revolution in Russia and cause Russia to topple. So,
well, they had some insight there.
They did, yes.
Was this in any case a matter of a country that you mentioned, Austria, Hungary in particular, the fading empire? Were any of these nations in a situation where they, the leadership at least, would welcome a war because it would supposedly unify the country that was so divided?
Well, that's one of the tragic things about World War I, is the same may be said of nearly all of the antagonists in this conflict. This is not unique to Germany or Austria-Hungary. And despite some sincere diplomatic overtures on the part of most of the combatants to try to resolve this short of hostilities, once the die had been cast and came up with war, there was almost a palpable sense of relief in many of these European capitals because now they could just get on with it. And this is an era in which Europe had not had a major conflict since 1815, almost a century, with the conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars. And when I say major, I mean something that historians might call total war.
That's France
a historiographically laden term, total war. But not since 1815 has the scourge of war scarred Europe. The wars that followed that after 50 years of peace, so-called cabinet wars, the wars of German unification, were generally more limited affairs, quite brief and so forth. And then toward the end of the 19th century, social Darwinism infects much of Western civilization, and the idea that certain cultures and certain races are superior to other cultures and races, and the solidification of nationalist identities that are more or less coterminous with the boundaries of these European states, these things all rise together at the same time and give birth to a very fierce sense of national identity in many of these European nations, along with this conviction that superior cultures are destined to compete against lesser cultures and vanquish them. And so this is a seen even by intellectuals, war is seen by intellectuals as the gymnasium of fit nations and superior cultures. And add to this a fairly potent notion of Victorian age masculinity, which is not exclusive to the Commonwealth countries and Great Britain as well. A lot of these men in these Western nations have been raised on tales of martial virtue from their grandfathers and so forth, and have not had an opportunity to prove themselves as men. The best that they've been able to accomplish is to live what Teddy Roosevelt called the strenuous life. And so it's a very quintessentially manly version of manhood to which many of them subscribe. And so war provides them all an opportunity to prove themselves as individual men and also to prove that the societies that they live in have the same virtues to which they aspire as individuals.
Well, it's one thing, to have these entangling alliances and the sense of honor and of proving one's masculinity. But what about overall war goals that these countries would have? Were they after territory?
Well, I think this is where the consensus view that Germany does deserve the lion's share of the blame for World War I is, in fact, pretty well deserved. And that is, once the war began in August of 1914, the Germans more or less began to conduct the war according to their plans. Historians refer to this as war by timetable, that these plans are finely detailed. They'd been planning for the invasion of France for quite some time, as they saw it as the most exigent, the most immediate threat. And then it's not until they've unleashed the dogs of war that they need to actually dwell upon what their actual objectives are. And it's in September of 1914 that the German Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, approves the September program. And the September program is fairly ambitious, and it does, in fact, amount to hegemony over Western Europe, the imposition of a German-friendly trading bloc, an exclusive trading bloc over that hegemonic sphere. In terms of goals to the east, that's a little bit more fluid. And in September of 1914, again, that's not central to their plans. They'll think about that as opportunity arises later. And they also, in September of 1914, declare the ambition to establish a colony in Africa that stretches from coast to coast in Africa. So Germany, as a kind of latecomer to the imperial game, as it's a relative latecomer to the community of powerful Western states at this time, feels it has some catching up to do, and it's feeling rather ambitious. And Africa has been subdivided amongst all of the European nations. Germany has some holdings there, but you're seeing in this program the markings of genuine naked imperial ambition that really cut against the grain, give the lie to the German defense that they had no option. They were surrounded by enemies, and their enemies' actions had precipitated the war.
Well, anybody who's ever played Risk knows that, you know, it just doesn't work that well when you're in the center of Europe to attack both sides and try to hold the South also.
That's quite true. That's quite
true. I guess they hadn't quite figured that out yet.
Of course, that game imparts realistic, I suppose, significance to Australia's continental defense as well.
That's so true, so true. Often proven. Well, we also hear a lot, though, about trench warfare, and we get the impression that this war on the European continent just by late 14 or into 15 had bogged down into trench warfare.
Well, there's a great deal of truth to that, certainly. And, you know, it's one of those interesting things about military history. Looking at the tactics of World War I, or for that matter, the linear tactics of the previous era of warfare, tactics used in the Civil War and the American Revolution, to the layperson looking at these tactics, or in particular, looking at cinematographic depictions of these tactics, it seems the height of criminal folly or incompetence to send men into battle using these tactics. It's not really within the parameters of our conversation today, but perhaps another time I can talk about why linear tactics made sense in the Civil War and the wars prior to that. In this instance, no one envisioned trench warfare tactics. They didn't have manuals. They didn't have doctrine that was based upon fighting from entrenchments and bogging down into that kind of warfare. But what you in fact had in this conflict was the application of military technologies that had advanced very rapidly over the second half of the 19th century and had not really had an adequate gestation period or period of testing or experimentation. So the Russo-Japanese War was the one great laboratory, for instance, that all Western observers looked at to see what war with machine guns and modern high-power, long-range artillery, which has been transformed from the Civil War era where cannons pointed their muzzles at the enemy and cannoneers looked at the enemy that they were shooting at, to World War I, where artillerymen are well behind the front lines and sending rounds miles and miles over
beyond
the lines.
What they could actually see.
Right, and striking not only enemies in their enemy forces in their trenches, but striking their marshalling yards, rail hubs, and things well to the rear. That's a transformative effect, and the advent of the machine gun, which is not really that new by 1914.
Sure.
It had been around, a real modern machine gun had been around since 1880. 85 and was slowly making its way into the tables of organization equipment for all Western armies to include the U.S. Army. But on the eve of the war, they're still thinking of machine guns as being sort of replacements for the old artillery, another weapon that you point at the enemy and look at him while you're shooting it. But the old artillery had been concentrated in batteries and sometimes larger than batteries. And as this war went along, they learned that machine gun is most effective when you actually give it to the infantry forces themselves.
Spread them out.
And they will miniaturize the machine gun as well. But the reality is firepower prevails in warfare at this time. Industrialization, the perfection of the Bessemer process, 1855, which enables for the production of cheap and incredibly high-quality steel, leads to advances in the explosives, leads to a far more deadly sort of warfare because of these advances that enhance the firepower and hence the killing power of every individual soldier on the battlefield. And it will take this terrible clash of 1914, 1915, and 1916 for armies to really come to grips with what this means for their doctrine and how they can overcome this. The missing pieces of this puzzle will also come largely from industrialization with further advancements, and that'll take the form of mechanization, the advent of
the
armored vehicles, the tanks in particular. And, of course, the tanks make their first appearances in World War I. In 1916, at the Battle of the Somme, we see the tanks introduced. The tanks by the end of the war are using a early version of doctrine that's not utterly unfamiliar to tankers of World War II, but that is a technology that really will not mature until the interwar period, which causes the German application of armor doctrine in 1939 to look revolutionary, but it's not remotely revolutionary. It's a natural evolution from what began on the Western Front in 1916. But one of the great misunderstandings, I think, about the trench warfare is it appears that no innovation is going on, and that's not true.
War almost always brings innovation, doesn't it?
There's a tremendous amount of innovation, and that innovation is going on at the tactical level. It's a technological innovation. Some of this innovation is horrific. I mean, one of the innovations is the use of poisonous gas.
I wanted to get to that next, mustard gas and chlorine gas. Was this brought in as a matter of like desperation when things bogged down, or was that kind of ongoing from the beginning?
No, I don't think that this is a matter of desperation. It's Germany. This is another consensus view, I think, established by recent scholarship as well as older scholarship. Germany's regard for international law and conventions extended exactly as far as German interests extended. And the moment that German interests outran international law and conventions, the Germans were more than happy to keep on going, whether that had to do with the invasion of neutral Belgium, or the sinking of completely unarmed, non-contraband carrying channel ferries. Germany reserved for itself what it deemed its sovereign right to do whatever was necessary to prevail in this war. And so the introduction of poisonous disabling gas was never really anything that caused any kind of moral qualms. The use of unrestricted submarine warfare, on the other hand, was not ever questioned within Germany on moral or ethical grounds, but rather on the prudence of continuing a practice that seemed destined to draw the Americans into the fight. And so when they suspended it, it was less out of an acknowledgement, you're right, we've really gone too far. It was you're right, we really don't want to
provoke
Americans
the Americans.
Right.
And we'll get into that American entry into World War I in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with John Hall, who is telling us about how America entered what was then known as the Great War. We call it today World War I. I want to just finish a point that we got into just before the break, though, John. You mentioned that the Germans were the first to use mustard gas and chlorine gas in the war. How quickly did the Allies respond in kind?
Very quickly. So this was I don't want to give the impression that the Germans were uniquely nefarious when it came to the application of poison gas in this war. In the vein of innovation, all sides were looking for solutions to disrupt the defensive networks, particularly on the Western Front, although gas was also used on the Eastern Front. One of the tragedies about the use of gas, however, is that although it killed and maimed thousands upon thousands of soldiers, in the end, it was utterly ineffectual in terms of actually changing the strategic situation. Countermeasures to protect oneself from gas were very, very quickly developed as well. Gas is fairly unpredictable in how it's going to behave. When Americans do enter the fray, they have, of course, less experience than their allied compatriots, and they don't realize that gas would oftentimes linger in low places, shell craters, for instance. And so during an attack, it seems natural that you would want to seek cover by getting down into some kind of low place on the ground. And a lot of American troops unfamiliar with gas would inadvertently expose themselves to it by diving into shell craters and seeking shelter there and inhaling the gas that was there. But they learned eventually how to protect themselves against gas, which, as I said, really did not affect the course of the war in any appreciable way.
How much of the detail of the horrors of this particular war, which was, as we've implied, I think, unprecedented in many ways, how many Americans were fully aware of what was going on in Europe at this time of American neutrality?
Oh, they're quite aware. They're very much aware. Americans are part of an Atlantic world, and they're also part of a Pacific world at this time. So economic interests gravitate in large measure to Latin America and to the Pacific, not to exclude America. But the United States views at the dawn of the 20th century its two principal competitors or potential military threats to be Great Britain as the paramount naval power of the Atlantic world and Japan as a burgeoning naval power in the Pacific world. In both instances, this poses something of a threat to America's economic interests defined by access to global markets and so forth. Nevertheless, the Americans are very, very familiar with what is going on in Europe. America's most famous journalists deployed to Europe to cover this war are writing back in serial pieces. And it's their early reportage which very quickly develops among Americans a deep and abiding sympathy for Belgium in particular.
Because despite its neutrality, the Germans had marched right through as part of their strategy to attack France.
Exactly. And the Belgians' valiant defense of their little nation wins admiration. And so because of this reporting and what's going on, the prevalent view in the United States in the fall of 1914 and in 1915 is not necessarily a sense of camaraderie with the Allied powers. There's still, as I said, Great Britain to this point, the special relationship of which Americans speak with Great Britain today has yet to really take hold. This is a nation that the United States had already fought two major wars against and remains a potential economic competitor in the Atlantic world. There's a great many Irish Americans, one of the largest immigrant populations,
who have no
love to lose on Great Britain. And so from the beginning of the war, it's not necessarily a pro-Allied sentiment as it is an anti-German sentiment. Germany looks like a bully nation that is preying upon weaker, defenseless neighboring countries, in particular on Belgium. At the same time, in the early years of the war, Americans, because Americans also, many of them claim German ancestry.
Sure.
And this is the largest immigrant group in the United States at the time as measured by the number of native speakers of German. It's the second most commonly spoke language in the nation. There are more German newspapers than any other foreign language newspapers in the country. But a widely held belief, 1914, 1915, is that this isn't really Germany, the country that many of us are from and that many of us have fond feelings toward, that is perpetrating this injustice. Rather, it is the Junkers of Prussia. It's the Kaiser. And it's Prussian militarists. And so there's a two Germanies sort of thesis that prevails. There's Germany, home of Mozart and Goethe and the arts and science and everything else. And Americans view a prevalent theory up until this time, you know, it's the Teutonic germ theory, that much of what made Americans exceptional they could trace. This is in line with the pseudoscientific racial theories of the day. They could trace back to in part to some German origins. And so there's part of a Germany that Americans still are sympathetic toward. And there's sympathy even for then for common Germans. This is what happens when an autocracy, a monarchy that's not representative of a real culture and its people steals the polity, if you will, and takes it down the wrong track.
One of the ironies of this is a little bit of a sidebar here, but is that the British monarchy – they were Germans.
Yes.
George I couldn't even speak English, brought over from Hanover, and he's the forebear of Victoria and, you know, George V and VI, who would be wartime leaders, and they were one big unhappy family.
Sure. And, of course, the House of Hanover changes its name because of this war to the House of Windsor to distance itself from its German origins, and that takes place as well in many cities across the United States, which change their names.
Berlin to Berlin.
Right. By the end of the conflict, at least to distance themselves from this conflict. Another phenomenon that's repeated, by the way, in the Second World War.
And then by 1915 or so, Americans were very well aware of what's going on in Europe. When do we first start getting voices that say America should enter this war?
From the very beginning, there are some hawkish Americans, such as Teddy Roosevelt, who think that America should get in this war for moral reasons and because it serves American interests. But those are sort of minority points of view. In 1915, however, there's a gradual drift of opinion from sort of a tacit sympathy with Belgium and disapproval of German actions in 1914 to 1915, a couple of seminal events which really begin to push American public opinion even further into an allied sympathetic orbit. In April of 1950, the Armenian genocide unfolds. That also is covered in the press.
Does that at the hands of the Ottoman Turks, who are allies of the Germans and Austro-Hungarians?
That's exactly right. And in keeping, again, with the sort of racialized view of mankind that many Americans subscribed to at the time, of course, the Turks wouldn't come up with something like this entirely on their own if they didn't have the license or if not the direction from the Kaiser himself to perpetrate this crime against humanity. So that's another strike against the two Germanies thesis. People are beginning to think that maybe Germany, in fact, has become corrupted. And the clearest evidence of that new suspicion comes just a month later in May of 1915 with the sinking of the Lusitania. And Lusitania is not just any passenger liner. This is the best known, most luxurious flagship, if you will, the Cunard line of transatlantic ocean liners. And the Germans deliberately targeted it because it was a symbol of British and Allied culture, affluence, arrogance, what have you. And in the wake of sinking the Lusitania, common German citizens celebrated. And there were commemorative coins cast.
Oh, that couldn't have gone over too well in the West.
To mark the sinking of the Lusitania, nearly 1,200 civilians died on the Lusitania.
It was 200 and some odd Americans.
128 Americans perished on the Lusitania. And the fact that Germany was not merely not penitent but celebrated the sinking of the Lusitania began to – at this point, the two Germany's thesis really lost a lot of currency, and a lot of Americans became convinced that Germany was definitely the aggressor and the party on the wrong side of this, even amongst German Americans. And most German Americans at this time were not recent immigrants. You've had the big wave of German immigrants, of course, came – the most recent big wave came following the revolutions of 1848. But you've got multiple generations here. An analogy that I find just fascinating and probably fairly telling, and I can't remember who used this, but to describe the position of German Americans at this stage of the war is like that of a son with a mother and a wife. And the mother is Germany and the wife is the United States. And as it, for most men in that situation, when mother and wife get into hardship, the husband almost invariably goes along with the wife. It doesn't mean that the husband's loses all sympathy for mother, but that in this instance as well, Germans may have been heartbroken by what they saw, but saw themselves foremost as American citizens. There were some exceptions to this, certainly, and some recent German immigrants actually did engage in acts of espionage and even some high-profile cases of sabotage in the United States. But by and large, German Americans remain steadfastly loyal to the United States. There's no record of any American citizens going home to Germany or Austro-Hungary to fight for the mother country, whereas there's ample evidence of that happening for immigrants to go home to fight for the Allies, or Americans, of course, going to Canada to fight for a neighboring country. But as attitudes against Germany turn more and more sour, most German Americans sort of double down on their commitment to the United States.
Well, the Germans, as you mentioned earlier, John, realized that the U-boat warfare, especially when conducted against non-combatant ships, was a political liability.
Right.
And so at some point after the Lusitania, they stopped.
Well, it's a indirect road, yes. Eventually, that they do stop these strikes on merchant vessels on pragmatic grounds, not merchant vessels, but rather on passenger liners on pragmatic grounds. Wilson, though, doesn't take a very hard line on this immediately after the sinking of the Lusitania. And in fact, he gets quite a bit of flack from more hawkish elements of society, particularly from Teddy Roosevelt and his followers. Just 3 days after the sinking of the Lusitania, Woodrow Wilson gave a speech in Philadelphia in which he proclaimed that the United States was too proud to fight. And that struck a wrong nerve with many Americans. The administration's response to the Lusitania was to send off a number of sternly worded diplomatic notes, and this also
protests.
Yes, and this also attracted a great deal of scorn from critics of the Wilson administration. It's not until the subsequent sinking of the Sussex, which is a channel ferry.
1916.
In 1916. And the Sussex, the Germans could justify, at least to their own satisfaction, the sinking of the Lusitania on the grounds that it was carrying war material, which it probably was. And in fact, I think it was doing that. And so on a technicality, they could claim that Great Britain owns responsibility for this. How dare they use passengers as human shields, if you will. When it came to the sinking of the Sussex, however, the Germans never even pretended to claim. They didn't believe there was contraband on it. They were deliberately killing civilians for the transgression of being within the sights of a U-boat periscope and its torpedo. In the wake of the Sussex sinking, the Wilson administration took a harder line, which it could do at this point because there's been some turnover in Wilson's cabinet. William Jennings Bryan, the well-known pacifist Secretary of State, resigned sort of in protest of the way that the administration had handled the Lusitania affair and the diplomatic communications in the wake of that. With Bryan out of the picture, the Wilson administration takes a little bit of a harder line. And the Wilson administration by this point also has kind of come around to the preparedness camp. There's a big debate in late 1915 and 1916 about whether or not the United States should get ready for this war, whether or not it intends to get in the conflict.
Yes, by now a familiar concept.
Right. And so the opposition to preparedness is fascinating. It comes in many varieties as well. But already by 1916, Wilson himself at least has subscribed to the belief the United States has an obligation to get ready for this war, whether or not we're going to get into it. And so the communications to Germany in the wake of the sinking of the Sussex are even more sternly worded, and Germany relents then and relaxes its unrestricted submarine warfare. The interesting thing that causes is it in large measure removes the war as an election issue in 1916. And so one of the things that you mentioned at the show's opening, that Wilson campaigned on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war," his campaign used that line. Wilson himself was not overly fond of the line because he did not view himself ultimately as being in control of the nation's destiny when it came to war. He realized that if Germany resumed unrestricted submarine warfare, that the United States would be at war. And his Republican antagonist, competitor in that 1916 election, also generally tried to avoid mention of the war in 1916, this partly being allowed by the reduction of tensions as Germany responded favorably in the wake of the Sussex sinking. But neither side really wants to talk about the war. The one exception to that is campaigning for Hughes, the Republican candidate in 1916, is Teddy Roosevelt, who more than ever wants the United States to get into this war. And so almost in spite of Hughes, in his stump speeches, he takes a very hawkish line, which may have in fact hurt Hughes's candidacy in what turned out to be a very close election.
We'll find out what finally broke the camel's back and got the U.S. into World War I when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with John Hall, and we're looking into the U.S. entry into World War I, which I'm not going to be providing anybody with a spoiler if I say it takes place in the spring of 1917. And we've, in our conversation, John, just gotten Wilson reelected in 1916, having kept us out of war, although it was not a campaign slogan that he would have chosen. What, however, is Wilson's thinking as the war drags in Europe into 1917?
Well, Wilson is celebrated or scorned, depending upon his contemporaries' points of view or scholars' points of view, as being an idealist, perhaps naively so.
Still thought that way by many.
In some instances. And Wilson does not want the United States to get involved in this war. He would like to cling to neutrality as long as possible. Of course, so too would many American manufacturers like to cling to neutrality and insist upon their rights to trade with all combatants based upon proximity and access to markets and the fact that Britain has blockaded Europe. What that means is the United States gets more and more closely integrated with the Allies, of course, as the war goes along. And there is, in 1916, sort of a palpable sense of hypocrisy that's infusing the United States as they come to view Germany as very much the bad guy. The United States is at once standing on a soapbox and touting a morally superior position of neutrality and talking about American ideals and principles, while at the same time it is getting fabulously wealthy over the course of the war by trading in war goods, principally with the Allies. Wilson, amongst other progressives, would like then to do more than just trade with combatants and assert the rights of a neutral power. Wilson would like to use the war as an opportunity to remake the world in a better image, as articulated by the 14 points that he issues in 1918 after the United States has entered the war. And so he does not commit to entering the war until he feels that he has no choice, but he does feel the United States does need to do more than just trade and sit by the side and moralize, that the United States should use its moral authority and its position of power to serve as an arbiter of the conflict and in the end help insist upon a new world order. This is where the naivete comes in. And one of the expressions of that is in January of 1917 when he delivered a speech in which he declared peace without victory as a goal. And again, it seems to be another refrain from the Too Proud to Fight song, and it strikes many Americans as being foolish, if nothing else. And then only 10 days after he makes this pronouncement, Germany resumes its unrestricted submarine warfare. At this point, Wilson is pretty much convinced that the United States can no longer avoid this conflict. And looking at the bright side, he sees that if the United States, in fact, does enter the war in a significant way and bears a large role in an eventual Allied victory. But because Wilson views his allies, his soon-to-be allies, as also being part of a backward monarchical European system, he prefers not to call them allies but rather associated powers. So it's an alliance of convenience against an order that he hopes to wash away. But following the restriction of unrestricted submarine warfare, he does see that the United States has to enter this fight, and that will make give the United States a better opportunity to implement Wilson's vision for a post-war order. He tries to get Congress to authorize then the arming of merchant ships. They can defend themselves. Congress demurs, and so he plays a trump card and he reveals to the public intelligence that British intelligence had shared with the United States back in January, an intercepted telegram in which the Germans promised Mexico that if they allied with the Central Powers and made things difficult in North America for the United States, that Germany would help them reclaim lands lost to the United States during the Mexican-American War.
This was the Zimmerman telegram.
This is the Zimmerman telegram, and it hits the United States like a thunderclap of sorts. And of course, what's even more convincing, though, other than this, is the daily losses of American shipping just off the eastern seaboard and across the Atlantic.
Why did the Germans resume it if they knew this risk that the U.S. would enter?
The Germans did not count on the United States' ability to mobilize in time to meaningfully affect the course of the war. It's a strategic gamble on the part of Germany.
Thought they could end it before the Americans would be a factor.
Their idea was that if they sank enough shipping, they could drive Britain out of the war and force France to sue for a negotiated peace before any American soldiers set foot in France. And they knew, they were positive that this would draw the United States into the war. But it was a strategic risk because to this point, the war was not going terribly well for them. They were caught in a war of attrition, in a conventional war of attrition, which is not a good war to be in when you have fewer soldiers than your enemies have.
And also
when you're landlocked and blockaded and have no way to import foodstuffs for a population that's increasingly suffering privation and demoralization as a course of the war. So it was a great strategic gamble that ultimately we know misfired for the Germans. That resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare, the shipping losses then allowed Wilson to go before Congress on April 2nd, 1917, and deliver a war message in which, still idealistic, if not naive, Wilson proclaimed his intent to wage a war to make the world safe for democracy. And so that is the stated war aim of the United States when it enters World War I, is Congress willfully and by a wide margin votes to declare war against the Central Powers. The problem then, having declared war on Germany, was that because Wilson was so committed to maintaining the protected and in his mind morally right position of a neutral, he had in many regards refused to allow the mobilization of his nation for war. There had been some half measures, some steps toward this in 1916, the most significant of which was the voting for a Navy second to none, which wasn't literally true as it would be second to the Royal Navy, but only to the Royal Navy eventually by the time all of that shipbuilding is complete. Since 1885, the United States had embraced a navalist program of sorts, and particularly after 1898, the United States had been a global colonial power
with
tremendous
war.
Influence in Latin America, South America, colonial territories to police and defend across the Pacific, and again the leading strategic interest was to maintain access to global trade. And a Navy was conducive to all of these things. And so this Navy bill is not directed exclusively against Germany, but also against Japan, which, although allied with Great Britain during the course of this war and then once America enters, ostensibly on the same side of this contest as the United States, has demonstrated a penchant for opportunism strategically in the Pacific world and ambition to even expand to the eastern side of the Pacific Ocean. And so this naval bill is directed against more than the
against the Japanese more than the Europeans.
Certainly they're both parts of the equation. And so when it comes to preparedness of the Navy, it takes a while to build ships, right? And so passing this legislation in early 1916 does not create a Navy overnight, but they do dedicate a fair amount of funding for that. When it comes to the rest of the military, however, it's largely unprepared. At the declaration of war, the United States has a regular army of less than 128,000 men and a National Guard of just over 80,000 men, and they will expand eventually to an army of over 2 million men. Over 2 million men will be brought
remarkable.
Into it, and they have to do this with the Selective Service Act in 1917, which is a real novel development. This war has been credited by many historians for creating modern America. And in saying that, what historians mean is this leads to the expansion of a bureaucratic professional state, the rise of bureaus, professional influence within Washington, tighter bonds between the government and industry over the course of the war, and the creation of a bureaucracy for managing American manpower in the Selective Service Act that had never existed before either. It's not the first draft in American history, and it represents something of a departure from the way that the United States had raised troops in the past. In that, given the scale of war now, there's the sense that we can't afford to rely exclusively on volunteerism, which is what had been the American tradition at this up to this point. Because of these Victorian age ideals of manhood, they recognized the people most likely to volunteer for this war were genuinely the nation's best and brightest.
In other words, we're not talking about the uneducated.
No, we're talking
about lower classes.
Blue-blooded Harvard graduates heading off to fight because they feel that this is their patriotic duty. It's an opportunity to prove themselves. And this happens similarly in Britain.
Sure.
And Americans have watched the flower of British youth all die.
That lost generation.
All die in a lost generation. And so one of the rationales behind the Selective Service Act was we need to moderate the way that we enlarge the force to make sure that the right people stay at home on the jobs and that we don't bleed away. It wasn't so much about protecting the children of the wealthy against their own wishes as it was trying to manage the war in a bureaucratic and scientific fashion.
It sounds, John, as if in so many ways this Great War, and be interesting to know at what point it started getting called World War One. I'm thinking about what Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1940 must have been thinking based on his knowledge of what had happened with American neutrality in 1917.
Well, he certainly had experience in terms of knowing because of the course of this war that you could not wait until the eve of hostilities to prepare the nation for war. And so while he is president, then he can see the storm clouds gathering and then bursting over Europe by September of 1939. FDR had taken measures to help convince his countrymen to prepare for war. And so you do see other novel innovations in the United States, such as in 1940, the introduction of the first peacetime draft in American history. As in the First World War, however, the Navy was better prepared for the war than was the Army, as Americans up until certainly through World War One, and a lot of the debates about preparedness hinged around this. This continued until the eve of World War II as well. Americans really were not fond and never had been historically of maintaining a robust and capable army in times of peace. Part of that was based upon faith that citizen soldiers made better soldiers, and you could wait until the time of emergency to call a father and son in from the fields and ask them to go to the reception center to train as soldiers. But also there's longstanding political tradition in the United States that felt that standing armies were inimical to our lowercase r Republican traditions of government in this country. That conviction largely dies with the Second World War, but it's still fairly powerful in 1916 as they debated how to prepare for this war. Do you expand the regular army? A lot of Americans did not want to do that. They would prefer that you expand the National Guard. And eventually they do both of those things and then add to that a brand new national army that's filled exclusively with those people conscripted by the Selective Service Act. And that way they're able to balance those competing traditions.
So a lot of our thinking about war and peace and the military's role in each, it really comes out of the legacy of World War One. John Hall, a pleasure always.
Thank you, Norman. Mine as well.
John Hall is a professor of history at UW-Madison and a member of the Wisconsin World War One Centennial Commission. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.